inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
This is Lynn Burnfield, and you are listening to The Lynn Show. If you're tuning in for the first time, welcome. Because the title of the show doesn't really tell you what it's about, I like to start the show with a short description of what you can expect. So if you've been listening, please forgive the repetition. In The Lynn Show, you can expect to hear a lot of information about change. Specifically, why we humans can't always do the things we want to do exactly when we want to do them. Much of this information will come from my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, which you can get, if you want it, by emailing me at Lynn Burnfield, that's Lynn with an E, and Burnfield with an E, one word, LynnBurnfield at gmail.com. So the information comes mostly from my book, but also from my 30 years' experience as a psychotherapist and a consultant. In addition to information about change and why you can't do what you might want to do, you'll be hearing music. Some of it, like the song that opened the show and the song that will close the show, is coming from my CD, which is called I Won't Go With a Whimper. And some of the songs, like the ones I'm going to play in this show, are by people who may not have record deals, you know, independent artists, so these songs cannot be heard on the radio or bought in a store. Not that anyone buys music in a store anymore. My CD, for example, can only be purchased on the internet at CD Baby, or from my car, of course. And actually, I went looking for a Dan Fogelberg CD because I did a tribute to him in my first show. And of course, there weren't any. I had to get those performances off of YouTube. God bless it. So you'll hear a mix of music and performers, some of whom you will know, some of whom you may not have heard before. In addition, I will be telling stories. Stories from my practice, stories from my own life, and stories from you, if you email me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com. I also want to be sure to mention my engineer, IT electronics guy, Josh the Wonderful, and tell you that if you need any computer, electronic, or recording services, you should get in touch with Josh. You can call him at 863-990-8349, or you can email him at Josh C. Hackney, that's H-A-C-K-N-E-Y, one word, Josh C. Hackney at yahoo.com. In this show, right after I play four songs from a terrific CD by a piano player and singer and entertainer, I'm going to continue talking about what I've been talking about, which is brain chemistry, and how the neurons that fire in our brain control what we feel and therefore what we can and cannot do. But now I'm going to introduce the music that you're going to hear with a story from my life. In the 70s, I moved to Los Angeles from New York City. And while I was living there, a teacher of mine arrived. His name was Mervyn Nelson. He was a teacher of a theatrical workshop. It was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever seen. I was taken there by a friend who was in the workshop. It took place in a kind of theater, and the seats were filled with students. The class started at 5 o'clock in the evening, I think. My friend and I were working in a place where we were working till 10 o'clock, so we didn't get there until 10:30, and it was still going on. It went on until everybody sitting in that auditorium got a chance to work. And what work meant was that you got up there and you did two songs. People were working on material for nightclub acts. They were working on audition material. And they would do their songs, and Mervyn would critique them. And sometimes, if the person was having trouble getting what he was saying, he would do it for them. And I will never forget it. This is a empty stage, not just a piano. And Mervyn would get up there and magically turn himself into whatever it was that he was trying to get you to do. And as I said, we didn't get there until 10:30, and we were almost always the last people to go on, but the thing went on from 5 till it was over, usually midnight. So I was living in L.A., and Mervyn came to visit. Well, Mervyn never went anywhere without an entourage. There were always people around him. And so when he came to L.A., he called me and said, "I'm here." And I said, "Oh, good. Where are we going?" And he had discovered somebody he knew somebody who had opened a showcase club in Hollywood. Her name was and is Diana Walker. And the showcase club was called The Power and Glory Unlimited. And I went with Mervyn and the crowd and sat in the little place and watched the performers. And the next day I called Diana up and said, "I'd like to audition for your showcase club." And I came down and did, and I worked in that club until we were closed because the laundromat next door complained that we were taking up all the parking spaces. And apparently that neighborhood wasn't zoned for a showcase club, and we were forced to close. But the reason I'm telling you this whole story is that it was there that I met Max Forsetter. He was the piano player. He didn't play for me because I played for myself, but he played for everybody else. And he describes himself as a piano bar entertainer. He's much, much more than that. He's a wonderful musician, a talented performer. He's funny and interesting and entertaining, and he's had a career of playing in every possible venue, weddings and cruise ships and bar mitzvahs and clubs and bars and you name it, Max has been there and played in it. And recently, although he's not been playing for many years, he did a concert, which fortunately was recorded, and he sent me the CDs from it. And I want to play some songs from that CD. I also, I don't want to forget to say, he's also a very talented astrologer. So when the CDs have been played, then, you know, I'll come back and I will tell you where you can write to him if you want to get the whole package. And also, if you want to get your chart done, Max is multi-talented. So, all right, I think that's enough information, enough introduction. And without further ado, this is Max, the piano player.
Tom Lehrer. Led two lives. One was Professor Tom Lehrer, teaching math and physics at Harvard and MIT. The other was Tom Lehrer writing weird, bizarre songs, like the Masochism Tango, and poisoning pigeons in the park, which I have taught to children. He wrote this song in the 1950s, and I can't think of any better way to introduce it than to read what he said in concert. Almost every day during the hunting season, you see at least one item in the newspapers about somebody who has shot somebody else, under the impression that he was a deer with a red hat, perhaps, or perhaps a large flesh-colored squirrel. At any rate, it seems to me that this marks an encouraging new trend in the field of blood sports and deserves a new type of hunting song, which I present herewith. More recently, he was interviewed and said, political satire died the day that the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Henry Kissinger. At any rate, let's put one across the bow of the vice presidential bunker. Will remember 'twas a year ago November. I went out to hunt some deer on a morning bright and clear. I went and shot the maximum the game laws would allow, 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. I was in no mood to trifle. I took down my trusty rifle and went out to stalk my prey. What a haul I made that day. I tied them to my fender and I drove them home somehow. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. The law was very firm. It took away my permit, the worst punishment I'd ever endured. It turned out there was a reason. Cows were out of season. And one of the hunters wasn't insured. People ask me how I do it, and I say there's nothing to it. You just stand there looking cute, and when something moves, you shoot. And there's 10 stuffed heads in my trophy room right now. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a purebred Guernsey cow. This next song was George Gershwin's final song before he died at the age of 37. A little too soon for me. This is called Love Is Here to Stay, and there's a short intro I do before, a little Gershwin noodling. it's very clear. Our love is here to stay, not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time they go. Is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. But our love is here to stay. It's amazing all the different things your average guy might need a lawyer for. Bernie tells me what to do. Bernie lays it on the line. Bernie says we sue, we sue. Bernie says we sign, we sign. I'm in touch with my attorney, Bernie. In a clutch, he can speed right to the scene. And if I'm locked up in the jail with just one phone call for my bail, he says to call his club, collect, or deal directly with his answering machine. And when I dine with my attorney, Bernie, he buys wine from the rare imported rack. That's cause Bernie is a purist, not your polyester tourist. Bernie waves the glass around a while, then takes a sip and always sends it back. Bernie tells me what to do. Bernie lays it on the line. Bernie
says we sue, we sue. Bernie says we sign, we sign. Ventures with the counterfeit debentures, but you win a few, you lose a few, like Bernie says, keep on hanging tough. Thanks to you, my attorney Bernie, thanks to you, I'm considered well-to-do. Sure, I made out like a bandit, just exactly like you planned it, but like Murray, my accountant told me yesterday, I owe it all to you. Bernie tells me what to do. Bernie lays it on the line. Bernie says we sue, we sue. Bernie says we sign, we sign. On the dotted line. Let's crunch a couple of numbers here. This was written in 1974 about events that happened in 1927. As of now, that's 80 years ago. But this song might just as well have been written last year. What has happened down here is that the winds have changed. Clouds roll in from the north and it started to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. The river rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. The river has busted through clear down to Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. Trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. President Coolidge come down on a railroad train with a little fat man with a notepad in his hand. President say, little fat man, isn't it a shame what the river has done to this poor cracker's land? Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away. Trying to wash us away. Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Max Forsetter and the 2-CD set called Max the Piano Player. I hope that you like those songs as much as I do. I never heard the song Louisiana, but I was really touched by it. It sounds to me like a Randy Newman song, but I don't know that for sure. Any Tom Lehrer song is, Always a treat. I am always glad to hear Tom Lehrer. It's what a remarkable guy. And Dave Frischberg's attorney Bernie is always fun, and who doesn't like George Gershwin, especially the noodling of Rhapsody in Blue. Absolutely wonderful. So if you want to hear these songs again, or any of the other songs on the 2-CD set, or get an astrological chart, you can write to Max. That is Max Forsetter, Forsetter. You have to write to him in snail mail at Post Office Box 608 in Mendocino, California, 95460. I'll say it again. It's Max Forsetter, Forsetter, Post Office Box 608 in Mendocino, California, 95460. Or you can write to me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com, and I will pass on your request to Max. Well, on to a more serious subject. Today, I'm going to continue to talk about brain chemistry and its effect on our behavior. For those of you who missed last week's show, I'm going to start with the recap with which I ended last week's show, explaining how the neurons which fire in our brain influence how we feel and therefore what we do, and then go on to tell you what I think you might be able to do about it. More often than we realize, we are reacting not to what is actually going on in our life, but to what our bloodstream is telling us about what's going on in our life. Neurons fire in our brain. They drop chemicals into our bloodstream, and these chemicals cause us to feel certain emotions. And then we make decisions about what we should do based on the emotion we're feeling. So if the chemical which causes anger drops into our bloodstream, we'll feel angry, and then we'll behave in an angry way. The problem with this is that sometimes, maybe even a lot of the time, our brain is dropping chemicals into our bloodstream which are inappropriate to the current situation and then causes us to react inappropriately, maybe even in a counterproductive way. This is because in an attempt to save us time and energy, our brain learns that certain situations require certain responses. And if a situation in the present resembles a situation in the past, the brain will immediately drop what it learned was the correct response. The correct chemical will then drop into our bloodstream. At least it's the learned correct chemical. But although the current situation may resemble the past situation, it may not require the chemical the brain learned was appropriate. For example, if as a child you were bitten by a dog, that experience certainly hurt and scared you. It is likely that your brain learned to associate dog with danger. And so as an adult, you may be uneasy with even small dogs and go out of your way to avoid dogs in general. Although many of these dogs won't be dangerous to you, of course. Your brain, having learned this lesson well, will be dropping the uh-oh chemical into your bloodstream whenever you're faced with a dog. Now, certainly possible to go through life quite well without ever having to come in contact with a dog, although I have to tell you that I got my first dog when I was 40. My husband announced one day that he had waited 22 years to have a space big enough for a dog. We just bought our first house. And so he went out and got a dog. Well, I'd never owned a dog because my mother is one of those people who got bitten when she was a kid and she was terrified of dogs. And I, although I had no unpleasant experiences with dogs, I had no experiences with dogs. So I was a little apprehensive, and my husband came home with an Akita. I don't know if any of you know what an Akita is. It's a very big dog. He was 120 pounds. And he looked like a bear. But my husband was right about him. He was the gentlest soul ever. I was able to learn about the glory of dog. We wound up with a male and a female and 8 puppies, and then we kept one from that litter. It was really glorious. So any of you whose brains have learned that dogs are dangerous or messy or difficult or a pain in the neck or whatever, I'm sorry for you, because although obviously you can get through life fine without ever having to deal with dog is a wonderful, wonderful thing. In any case, even though you can get through life without having to come in contact with a dog, let's say you had an experience that convinced you that men were not to be trusted, or that if you didn't put everything away neatly, you would be punished. You can see how these learnings would profoundly affect your ability to function as an adult. Because, obviously, well, maybe it's not obvious to those of you who have had this experience, but, well, I guess you just have to take my word for it, all men are not dangerous. And there are even times when it's not okay, but actually, not only okay, but actually necessary not to make your bed or put everything in its proper place. So, can you think of ways in which you may be experiencing mistaken neural firings? Do you have behaviors that don't make sense to you? Do you do things and act in ways that you wish you wouldn't or wish you could stop? Do you find yourself getting angry or defensive or nervous and then wonder why on earth these feelings seem to overtake you? Or maybe it's easier for you to see that in other people. Maybe it's easier for you to see other people overtaken by feelings and then having behaviors that seem to be overreactions to what's actually happening. When we have a powerful or intense experience, or we have the same experience many times, our brain learns to associate that experience with the feeling that went with it. It creates a feedback loop between the experience and the emotion it generated, and then it stores that information. So that whenever we have an experience which even resembles the original one, it triggers an automatic response and creates the feeling that had been associated with the early experience. In this way, we are just like Pavlov's dogs, who learned to associate the sound of the bell with feeding time, so that whenever the bell rang, they salivated. This happened even when there was no food present. When I was 18 months old, my dad was drafted into the army to fight in World War II. I adored my dad, and I can only imagine the pain of that loss. 3 years later, he returned, but the experience of having lost him stayed with me. And I lived with, although I was completely unaware of it, the fear of abandonment. The certainty, actually, that I would be abandoned. Many years later, I moved in with the man I would marry, and when we'd been living together for about 2 years, one day I woke up thinking, gee, maybe he isn't going to leave. This thought really surprised me because I hadn't been consciously aware that I'd expected him to leave. Ironically, after I decided he wasn't going to leave me of his own free will, I found myself worrying that he would die. He'd get run over by a truck, or something catastrophic would happen. Something would take him away. The certainty, the fear that something would take him away from me was very, very powerful. But it was based entirely on a lesson I'd learned at 2 years old. It had nothing to do with my current reality. Having had this experience leads me to believe that there are millions of us whose parents went off to fight in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, Iraq, who are suffering from abandonment fears, and have no idea how that experience is dictating their behavior or impacting what they can and can't do in their lives or what they expect will happen to them. In a minute, actually 51 seconds, I'm going to tell you what you can do about this, but first I'm going to play a track from my CD. It's 51 seconds long. It's me at 2 years old singing Zippity Doodah. You can hear my mom singing along with me in the background. That was my very first recording, and we made it so my mom could send it to my dad overseas. And here I am at not just 2 years old.
Lynn Burnfield of the Royal Associated Studio singing Zippity Doodah.
My, oh my, what a wonderful day. Friendly and sunshine, and my way. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay. Mr. Bluebird on my shoulder. The truth, I thought so. Every little satisfaction, zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay. Wonderful feeling, wonderful day.
When I listen to that, I try to imagine what that little girl made of having Daddy be there one day and gone the next. And actually, it reminds me of something I saw one of my dogs go through. As I was saying earlier, we had three dogs. We had a male, a female, and a puppy from their litter. Shortly before we moved from Los Angeles to Florida, both the male and the female died. Akitas are very big dogs, and big dogs don't live long lives, and ours lived longer than many. They were 12 and 14 years old. Then my husband put our remaining dog in a van and drove her cross country. So when she arrived in Florida, she'd lost her mom, her dad, her house, and the life that she had known. For months, she didn't allow either my husband or I to leave the room without following us. I'm sure she was trying to make sure that no one else was going to disappear. Her brain had learned that she could lose those closest to her without warning. So what can we do about it if we're stuck with a neural firing that keeps us from experiencing life as it really is? How do we get our brains to unlearn the lessons they'd learned? How do we get them to stop dropping that wrong chemical into our bloodstream? How do we change brain chemistry? Well, first, it's necessary to notice that it's happening. When you're having a reaction which seems to you to be an overreaction or just inappropriate to the situation, you tell yourself the truth. This is a mistake that my brain is making. If you can trace the reaction that you're having to the original situation that embedded it, you remind yourself of that. For example, if you're afraid of dogs because you were bitten as a child and you know that the dog in the room is not dangerous, you say to yourself, the reaction I'm having is based on what happened to me as a child, and I don't have to be afraid. Of course, the chances are good that this will not banish your fear there and then, although it might actually lessen it. What it will do is begin to add to the neural firing. So now, instead of the firing containing only the experience, dog, and the reaction, fear, it will contain the experience, the reaction, and the new information. If you're able to do this every time you're in the presence of a dog, over time, the additional information you're adding to the firing will become part of the triggered response. So where you used to have only dog fear, now you'll have dog fear, oh, maybe I don't have to be afraid. And a new neural firing will be being created. Brain chemistry will be being changed. I don't think you'll ever be completely at ease. You may always experience a twinge of fear in the presence of a dog, but the new information will have become part of your response so that it can be easier and easier for you to be in the presence of dogs. When I realized that my fear that something bad was going to happen to my boyfriend was really part of a childhood experience and not the reality whenever it was triggered, I also remembered that it was a mistake and was able to feel calmer. Of course, the fact that nothing bad ever actually happened to him helped to add to this new information in my brain. And if you get yourself a sweet dog, that will help too. Now I'm going to tell you a story of a neural firing which was about to cost a man $1 million. I got a call one day from a lawyer who wanted to refer his client to me. The client, who I will call Tom, was suing a trucking company because one of their trucks had lost control on a steep incline on the Grapevine, a very dangerous stretch of road in California, and run over Tom's car. Tom had suffered multiple injuries and was now as recovered as he ever would be, but still not only in constant pain, but he could only lift his right arm halfway up. This would be a disaster for anyone, but especially for Tom, whose work was being a Finnish carpenter and whose hobbies were playing guitar and sailing. There was no question that Tom's life had been devastated by this accident, which was in no way his fault, and the lawyer was suing for $1 million, at that time a very large settlement. The problem was that Tom was not behaving as though he had suffering as much as he actually was, and his lawyer was very worried that in testifying, Tom would downplay his injuries and hurt his case. So Tom came to see me. He was a tall, nice-looking man in his mid-30s. He was polite and soft-spoken, and he didn't know what all the fuss was about, he said. We talked about what had happened to him and then about his life in general. Tom explained that he was married and he was the pillar. He was the rock for both his wife and for his family, both extended family, his family of origin and hers. It became clear that being strong, not appearing to be needy, was very important to Tom. In fact, it was so important he was about to jeopardize the settlement, which would make the difference between a safe and an unsafe life for him and his wife, rather than present himself as needy. His lawyer, his wife, the rest of the family all tried to get him to see that this was unnecessary, but Tom just couldn't show his vulnerability. After a while, even Tom came to see that it would be better if he could be truthful about what had happened to him, but seeing that didn't make it possible for him to do it. So we looked into his childhood, and there we found the neural firing which was controlling him and making him act in a way that was not only not in his best interest, but downright dangerous to his future. Tom was one of 7 children from a very, very poor family. Dad worked every hour that he could, leaving Mom to take care of everything else. Tom was her youngest and her favorite. He told me that whenever he cried, she would send him off to the crying tree until he got it out of his system. My first thought was that this was unkind, but when we did a guided imagery around this experience, Tom remembered vividly that as he looked back towards the house from where he stood at the crying tree, he saw his mother's face and knew that his tears were just too painful for her to bear. Little Tom loved his mommy, and at that moment he determined that he would never cry again, would never make mommy feel bad again. Tom was 4 years old, and he never did cry again. Now, when, metaphorically speaking, crying was what he needed to do, the impulse to act hurt, which of course he was, triggered the memory of his mother's face, and the stoic chemical which dropped into his bloodstream stopped him cold. I'm delighted to say that recognizing this and the work we did successfully helped Tom change his learned response, and he won his case. So, while I've been talking about neural firings and lessons that your brain learned long ago that are not appropriate to the life you're living today, have you been thinking about yourself? Have you been wondering what old learnings may be getting in the way of something you want to do today? Have you thought of something? Well, why don't we do a little guided imagery here and now and see if you can discover a lesson that your brain learned a long time ago, which is getting in your way today. Maybe a behavior you'd like to change or something some important people in your life are complaining about. Take a moment and let your mind wander and see if something occurs to you. Have you got something? Well, if you do, great. You can use it for this exercise. If nothing occurred to you, but you're curious, well, then you can just do the exercise along with the rest of us and see what might occur to you. For those of you who are unfamiliar with guided imagery, let me explain. You probably know that you have both a conscious and an unconscious mind. Mostly, we are aware of what's going on in our conscious mind. It holds all the information that we process most of the time. But we also have an unconscious mind. And that also has a lot of valuable information for us, but we are mostly unaware of that information, or we get it in a sort of indirect way. When you do a guided imagery exercise, you offer your unconscious an opportunity to give you some of that information in a more direct way. In my book, When You Can, You Will, I talk a lot about the conscious and the unconscious. I have a chapter or two, actually, on the conscious and the unconscious. I explain how the unconscious talks to us indirectly with things like the Freudian slip or forgetting to remember. And this may be a good time to tell you that if you want to get the book or the workbook that goes with it that has other exercises like this or the audio book, or you just want to write to me, you can do that at lynnburnfield@gmail.com. I spell my name with ease. Not easily, but with the letter E. That's lynnburnfield@gmail.com. So, okay, let's take a shot at this exercise. If you're sitting at your computer, well, or wherever you're sitting, get as comfortable as you can and send the message of relaxation to your body. And this is another opportunity for you to learn something about yourself. It's my experience that even when we think we are completely relaxed, that is even in sleep, you know, some part of us may very well not be relaxed. It's holding on. And we're not usually aware of that until we pay attention. So if you think that you have sent the message of relaxation to your body, you might want to scan it and see if there's some place in your body that's still holding on. Are your shoulders a little hunched? Is your jaw somewhat clenched? Are your hands and fists, or have they spread out? Or maybe it's your legs or your arms which continue to hold tension. We all have our place. It's not necessary to unwind those places in order to do this exercise. But again, it can be interesting because you know that wherever you're holding that tension, that's a place that will suffer more wear and tear than the rest of your body, and that's just good to know. So, okay, are you comfortable? Are you as relaxed as you can be? Good. Now, if it feels okay to you, why don't you let your eyes close? We do this exercise with closed eyes, if we can, because it helps us focus inwardly. The information we want is internal, and while our eyes are open, we're liable to get distracted by what we see. Anyway, again, it isn't essential to close your eyes, but it can help. So I'm going to talk for a little while, guiding you through this exercise, and then I'm going to play about a minute of music to let your unconscious give you whatever it thinks you can use at this time, and then I'll talk again. As you're sitting there, as relaxed as you can be, please notice your breathing. Notice if you're breathing through your nose or your mouth, into your belly or your chest, if your breath is deep or shallow, but mostly notice that you are not breathing. You are being breathed by your body. This is not something you do. It is done for you. And so it is with information you receive from your unconscious. It is not something you can figure out or force. It can only be received. So when I next say the word now, I'll start to play about a minute of music. And during that time, you can wonder what, if anything, your unconscious wants to show you or tell you about an early learning which may no longer be serving you. And you can begin to wonder about that right now. So, did you learn anything? Could you see a connection between something you're struggling with today and an experience you had earlier in your life? Did you become aware of the source of something that is causing you fear or pain or sadness today? If you did, congratulate yourself. You are on your way to changing the brain chemistry which keeps you stuck in the past. The brain chemistry that creates a filter through which you see the world and which makes it impossible for you to see the world as it really is. If you did make some connection, the next step towards changing your brain chemistry is just to be aware of it when it happens. That is, every time you have an experience in the present, for example, you become anxious when you see a dog, or when somebody raises their voice, or when you have to confront someone in your own self-defense, or whatever it is that stops you from being who you want to be, take a moment to remind yourself that this reaction is being caused by an old neural firing. Try to recall the earlier experience which caused it and congratulate yourself on knowing this, on having this information. But don't expect the behavior to change immediately. It's a process. I'll talk more about that next week. In the meantime, just feel good about the fact that you are on your way, and know that when you can change, you will. And if you did make some connection, I would love to hear about it. So please email me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com. That's Lynn Burnfield, one word, LYNNE. BERNFIELD @gmail.com. And by the way, that beautiful flute music was courtesy of Jane Hoffman, the flute lady, from her CD, A Journey. The song was called Coco Pelli. It's the 7th track on her CD. And you can learn more about Jane, her music, the CD, and where she's appearing at her website, www.janehoffmanoneword.org. And the music you hear at the beginning and the end of this show is on my CD, which you can hear and buy at cdbaby.com. That's cdbaby.com/CD, Lynn Burnfield. And that brings us to the end of the show. This has been Lynn Burnfield, your host for The Lynn Show. I'll be here next week, Tuesday at 1 o'clock on the Radio Ear Network, and I hope that you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten